I don't really see many familiar faces, but I've only been at this university for 1 year, so it's probably not surprising. Can I ask just as a quick question, how many of you have taken psychology? It's a few. More than 1 year? Okay. Well, some of this may seem a little repetitious to some of you, but I guess it'll be justified in the end, perhaps. I'd like to, given the nature of the seminar topic for this week, it's values, science, and all that good stuff, I really think it's important that you have just a little bit of an idea of where I'm coming from. And the main reason is that we're going to be talking briefly about science and whether or not it's value-free, which I consider to be absurd, and particularly absurd in relation to psychology. But given that, I think it's just as well that you know my biases and where I'm sort of coming from. I have a very traditional psychology background, at least from my undergraduate years. I come from, originally from the University of Sydney, and there's probably not a more stodgy psychology department in the whole of Australia in terms of the way you go through and the emphasis on methodology and the values of science and all those good things. I taught at Sydney University for a while and then was a little disenchanted with my choice in careers. And due to a number of factors, I discovered a program which I thought would suit my interests and still keep me in psychology. And I went to... yes, come in. And so I went to the University of Kansas, where I did my graduate studies. Now this is about one of the tightest behavioural schools that you could go to. When I mean behavioural, I mean that the emphasis is totally on environmental control of many of the aspects that we'll be discussing. Now, I'll be talking about it today in relation to women's studies. That's not what I've usually been talking about. In fact, this is the first time I've sort of applied my knowledge to this particular area. But certainly, I've been interested in solving what are often regarded as social problems. And to do that, it seems to me that you've got to get away from talking about airy-fairy things that are going on inside and look at the social context of where problems are and where they're coming from and what you can do about it. You're not going to solve a problem simply by hypothesizing numerous inner mechanisms and dynamic control. And I think that it's important that you understand that's my bias, because I particularly, when we get on to Freud, just find it absolutely, totally intolerable and unacceptable. You know, I'd like to make sure that you're quite clear on bias where I'm coming from. Anyway, today we're going to talk, really, just have a sort of a general introduction to the psychology of women. It's almost an impossible topic in three lectures to adequately think you can even cover a fair sample of the area. But and so because of that, I won't be sticking too much, or at least totally, to the seminar topics that are outlined for the next 3 weeks. What I'll be trying to do is, for the most part, take a different tack. I have, though, tried to stick to today's topic a little bit more closely. Psychology, for those of you who haven't taken the course, has probably been defined in 5,000 different ways. But for the most part, perhaps the most common definition in introductory textbooks today is something like psychology is the scientific study of behaviour. And the emphasis is on scientific and behaviour. Early in its history, psychology was not a science, of course. It was part of philosophy. And in those days was much more concerned with the inner workings of the mind. Now, about 100 years ago, in fact, exactly 100 years ago, come to think of it, Wilhelm Wundt founded the first psychological laboratory. And this was the, you know, sort of big event. It's being celebrated all over the world this year by those departments of psychology which have any historical paraphernalia that they've collected. Like the University of Sydney set up a special museum to celebrate this particular event, psychology as a science. And, you know, that's important too, because psychology is a very new science, if you grant it that status. And having granted it that status, it's something that psychology is very, very sensitive about. Everybody knows that it's better to be a science than to be, you know, something more liberal. So that's the bias of psychologists in general. Now, I'm not going to dwell on how we define a science too much, but roughly speaking, we're talking about something which refers to a body of knowledge which is derived from observation, study, and experimentation. And the experimentation, observation, is really the hallmark in terms of psychology. But most of all, science, I think, is defined in terms of its methodology. And we're talking here about some kind of objectivity. And this is the real crunch, because we're talking, on the one hand, we want to talk about a value-free science, a science which, you know, just sits back and observes, collects the data, defines everything so that the next person can come in and check out an identical situation. We write it all out and we communicate it to our fellow scientists. And, you know, these are the important things. The hallmark, perhaps, of science is that the measurement systems must be repeatable and they must be communicable. You must be able to pass things on to people. And on top of all that, if you have a theory, the theory must be able to yield predictions. Now, in general, so we are told, the psychologist's task is to explore behavior systematically, not by whim or personal bias or fashion or interest of the moment, but systematically, so that eventually we're going to understand, we're going to put together all the components that everybody has ever looked at in terms of an organism, put it all together, and we'll come up with one explanation called the psychological explanation of the behaving organism. And that's you or the white rat or any other animal that you're interested in. Now, there's little doubt, I think, probably in anybody's mind, that science has promoted incredible technological changes in our society. I noticed our hallowed Prime Minister stating last night that only the pessimists are troubled about the value of science. The optimists know it will lead us ever onward to greater glory. So I don't know if you'll take any comfort in that. The truth is that the validity of science in ministering to the benefit of humanity may not be troubling the Prime Minister, but it is in fact troubling quite a few other people, including scientists. And some of these have begun to seriously challenge the nature of what science is. Kranzberg, for example, is quite an eminent psychologist in the American, Academy of Science fellow, has asserted that the myth of the neutrality of science has long since founded upon a bedrock of evidence that both theories and applications of science have had a continuing effect on our history. In other words, he's saying, you know, it's just a total myth that science is neutral, value-free, and simply objective in what it discovers and applies. This myth of neutrality in terms of science as a general phenomenon can also be applied to psychology. In fact, a very nice examination of this question has been by Alex Carey. I don't know if any of you will get around to reading it, but just in case. Who has said pretty much that the results of experiments carried out by psychologists are definitely not value-free. And he includes a quotation from Bertrand Russell, which I thought was particularly appropriate to our topic today. Russell, in 1927, said, "I must say broadly that all the animals that have been carefully observed have behaved so as to confirm the philosophy in which the observer believed before his observations began." Russell is here talking about psychologists. "Nay," he said, "more than that, they have all displayed the national characteristics of the observer. Animals studied by Americans rush about frantically, with an incredible display of hustle and pep, and at last achieved the desired result by chance. Animals displayed by Germans sit still and think, and at last evolved the solution out of their inner consciousness. Well, I think that Russell is probably pretty right about a lot of the psychological experiments that have been going on. But we need to be very sensitive to these issues, because if science is not value-free, and psychology is not value-free, the psychology of women is as open to bias as anything I could possibly dream up. Probably the most single vulnerable area in all of psychology, I would think, to prejudice. These sorts of sentiments have been expressed for some time. They were expressed by a psychologist called Helen Woolley in 1910, when she was talking about sex differences, and she argued that there is perhaps no field aspiring to be scientific where flagrant personal bias, logic martyred in the cause of supporting prejudice, unfounded assertions and even sentimental rotten drivel have run riot to such an extent as here. This is talking about the sex differences. Now, it's quite clear, if we look around us, that the current positions of men and women in this country certainly occur in different social, political, and economic areas. It's predominantly men who occupy the positions of power, status, and prestige. There are something like 35% almost of women in the workforce. There is certainly nothing like that in terms of women's representation in across the occupational strata. I was interested some months ago. I was elected departmental representative to the science faculty, which is not an exotic or a fascinating position to hold. It's simply that somebody has to do it. And I went along to the first meeting and looked around a room literally full, in which there were three women. And, you know, I was really kind of stunned that the representation was so low. But we need to be concerned about why the position of women is so different within our society. And the particular interest that we're going to try and take is, you know, what are the psychological reasons for this? What sorts of things can we look at? Now, there's no question but that the psychology of women is open to substantial bias. And it's true that perhaps that the reason it's so open to bias is that it's a subject on which everybody considers themselves to be an expert. Everybody, in this case, if you're looking at those who write on the subject, everybody usually means men. But it has been, it's true that writers from all walks of life, no matter what they are, where they come from, have tried to capture the essence of women and describe this particular being. And you all know the stereotypes, I'm sure. Man is active, woman is passive and dependent. If we believe Theodore Reich, we'd believe that women in general want to be loved for what they are and men for what they accomplish. The first for their looks and charms and the latter for their actions. Or Bruno Bettelheim, who's a psychoanalytic psychologist, who asserts that as much as women want to be good scientists and engineers, they first and foremost want to be womanly companions of men and to be mothers. And on top of all that, if woman steps out of that natural role, somehow disaster is going to overtake us. Frigidity, for example, as we see it today, is an outgrowth of woman's running away from her biological destiny, which is to be wife, mother, and homemaker. So, step out of your role and be fearful. Aside from the fact that these sorts of quotations, and there are thousands of them, which I'm sure you're running across in your readings, are quite often virulent and nasty, the most striking feature is that they regard all women as alike. They stereotype. It's the prime psychological thing. It's the easy thing to do. You generalize about all women on the basis of this loosely held, simple-minded stereotypes. Now, if you think about this today in terms of racism, there are still racists, obviously. They surround us quite literally. But it's not quite polite anymore in most circles to make your racism evident. It's still a lot more acceptable to be able to make jokes about the stupidity of women, to dwell on mother-in-laws and wife type jokes, anything which infers the beauty above brains kind of syndrome. And jokes particularly in certain areas such as women's driving capacities, for example, are seen quite acceptable by some people that one might on other dimensions consider to be reasonably intelligent and wholesome human beings. This ideology of sexism, I guess we can call it, is so deeply ingrained in our society that most people remain totally unaware of their prejudice. And I'm talking about people here, I'm talking about men and women. It's not that men have this total thing all by themselves. Women are perhaps the most active supporters of these stereotypes. The notion that women are inferior, or at least extremely different, which is merely a polite way of saying that they're inferior, is seen by many people to be a natural state of affairs. It's the natural order. Furthermore, like most stereotypes, the sexist stereotype is internally inconsistent. And you often find this when you start looking at stereotypes in general for psychological purposes. So depending on the purpose of the exercise, two quite different sets of characteristics can be attributed to women. Women are not supposed to be the leaders in our society, to be the judges, politicians, professors, and so on. They're not supposed to be those things because they're flighty, over-emotional, and sentimental. They don't have the skills which fit them for those leadership-type activities. But they also can't be the great poets, painters, and artists, writers, because they're practical, unspontaneous, and unimaginative. So you lose out on both ends in the stereotype sense. And inconsistency like that never managed to destroy a good, healthy stereotype. Sexism is certainly very robust today. But psychology has at last begun to be concerned with the nature of women, and it is finally possible to start examining some aspects of the sexist ideology from a psychological perspective. But this is a very recent event. You remember I mentioned that psychology is a very young science. When the laboratory opened in Leipzig in 1879, the main focus was on examining the attributes of sensation, neural reactions, visual and auditory perception, all those sorts of much more specifically experimental types of areas. Sex differences in these phenomena were neither postulated nor found. And there was no interest in that time, certainly, in any kind of separate psychology of women. It just wasn't relevant. Even around the time of World War II, when social conditions changed, the kinds of roles that women were beginning to fulfill, a separate psychology of women did not appear. Perhaps it was there was just plain no incentive to have a psychology of women, as both men and women appeared, at least, to be accepting their natural roles. Psychologists generally played along with this. They just weren't concerned to stir anything up in particular. They conformed to the existing social currents. Never occurred to anybody to look for sex differences in a variety of areas. What you did was look separately. You studied women in terms of their attitudes to homekeeping and child rearing and so on. You studied women in terms of occupational attitudes and motivations. What sorts of things makes a person get to the top? Not until the 60s really, and the push of the liberation movement, did a separate psychology of women even seem to be needed. And originally it was the psychology of sex differences which did emerge. People did become to be interested in what are the differences in terms of what we already examine and measure in people. Now, you can see the tremendous growth in this area by looking at, let's say, the psychological abstracts. In 1965, there were 50 reports on sex differences. 1975, there were over 500. So there's tremendous growth in that period. I'm not suggesting this is a psychology of women, but at least psychology is turning to look at some of the differences between men and women. It may seem that these data are quite encouraging in terms of the development of a psychology of women, but they're really not an adequate index of understanding. We're getting a lot of quantity in certain areas, but perhaps not the quality of investigation that will really be needed. Sue Cox, in her book, which is called Female Psychology, The Emerging Self, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's an excellent. Psychology. '76, I think, has argued that a really useful psychology of women needs to be significantly related to the principles and theories of feminism if we are going to discover aspects which traditional psychology has not been able to do. In other words, she's saying psychology's got to come from a different tack. It's got to sort of take up the feminist kind of perspective and approach psychological investigations from that. We stick to the major orientation in psychology, the traditional orientation, which is taught in most places, most of the time, then we're not going to find the answers, probably. Now, Cox has, there are obviously very different definitions of feminism, but just to give you the picture for Cox for a moment, because I want to talk about some of her ideas. For Cox, feminists are women who agree that we live in a male-dominated society. She has three basic criteria. One is that we agree that we live in a male-dominated society in which women remain largely unacknowledged and invalidated as any source of power. The second, she says, is that feminists are those who are interested in eliminating the negative values placed on women. What is the attributes that describe women as secondary, weak, lower. And three, she sees feminists as people who are engaged in the struggle to liberate both men and women. Now that's Cox's definition of feminist. Perhaps of more importance than defining what feminism is the issue of the impact of feminism, which is something that psychology might well tackle at some point in time. But so far it hasn't. Cox points out to a number of fears that feminism promotes or arouses in people. You can generate, I'm sure, a whole list of these fears. But there certainly are many people who are very much afraid of feminism. And some of these reasons, some of these fears, are things like, for example, the fear that feminists will want to reverse the present position, the fear of role reversal, that men will be subservient and women dominant. Another fear is that we'll lose our sex role identity. Well, that's pretty understandable. Your sex role, whatever it is a very strong part of yourself. And people do fear losing parts of them. Another fear is that feminism will perhaps prescribe specific behaviour so that you'll be controlled by the rules of feminism, as opposed to some other form of control. And there are a whole variety of others, things like the fear of androgyny, we're all going to get to be too much alike, or a fear of bisexuality and homosexuality increasing, or a fear of just plain any kind of change because of the uncertainty involved. People get very used to the status quo, it's much more comfortable. Now, there are obviously many types of fear, and you can add to that, but I think it's important to be sensitive to that fact, because it certainly influences the way people tackle a whole variety of issues, including the way they tackle psychological problems or investigations. Now, Cox is arguing that a proper psychology of women, a useful psychology of women, will need to be based on feminist perspective and to shake off the male, which at this point we're regarding as traditional, viewpoint. We talked before about how pervasive the male viewpoint is. It's just so pervasive and dominant in our culture that most of the time we fail to recognize it, mistake it for reality. Now, Cox gives what I think is a quite good example of this. Before I go on, can I ask, do we have any left-handers in the group? Three, that's about par for the course. Now, can you tell me, any of you, have you ever felt that life is not organized around your left-handedness? You ever been in a situation where it's awkward?
Yeah.
Like what? So you had to shift houses. Was your mother right-handed? Temporarily, at least. Was your mother right-handed? Uh-huh. What about you?
Mm-hmm. I was lots of little things like even rulers of sense of doing. I sort of had I was used to read rules backwards. Lots of little things.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't really.
There was someone else too.
Yeah, things like being at school, you've got kind of one table with an arm on one side. I mean, they're geared for right hands, so you know, maneuver yourself into a comfortable.
So I can empathise with that. I found myself out at the CAE the other day and I was supposed to be talking to a group of people and I just sat down in the first chair and it happened to be one for left-handers. And so I had to kind of slew around like this. It really put it out. The reason I wanted to sort of bring that up is that left-handers, I think you can equate that with, in some ways, with being a woman. And this is what Cox does, and I think it's a very useful analogy. Just to demonstrate how pervasive and subtle the viewpoint is, she compares left-handers and women. Now, the fact that our culture is predominantly right-handed is not noticed by the most of us who are right-handed. It just never enters our heads because we've never been inconvenienced by it. But people who are left-handed can probably cite many, many examples of situations where things are much more awkward. Now, you have to look then, given that you've got this awkward situation, at how you adjust to it. You know, if you're a left-hander, there are many adjustments you can make to the right-handed dominant culture. You can fail to notice the problem. I think one of our people said that they sort of didn't really realise how hard it was until just recently. You sort of don't let it penetrate into your knowledge. Or then when you do find out, you kind of pretend that it really doesn't bother you, maybe. Another thing you can do is blame yourself. You know, if only I wasn't so naturally clumsy, things would be easier, which is another easy kind of way around the problem. Or you can assume that right-handers deserve their dominant culture. After all, they are the majority, and, you know, that's the way it goes. Now, if you shift from being left-handed and thinking about being a woman in this situation, I think that many women fail to recognise or ignore the differences which are existing all around us. For the most part, we live in a male-dominated society. Perspective is male, and it is so permeated us that we don't even notice it half the time, maybe more than half the time for most of us. You can adjust to it in a different way. If you do notice, you can start saying things like, well, if only I was more beautiful, more talented, I wouldn't have these problems. I could adjust more easily. Or you can acknowledge that the male is dominant and pretend that it really doesn't matter. You like things the way it is. You're happy to live with it. Okay. So I think the analogy between left-handers and women is probably a good one. Now, a much different reaction is to notice those kinds of differences. Left-handed people, for example, can notice that there are problems in living in a right-handed culture. They might be able to make some adjustments which are more useful. For example, buying left-handed equipment, which one of our people was talking about. There's all sorts of things that are designed for right-handers which could legitimately be designed for left-handers and make life a whole lot easier. And I think we can try and change the culture a little bit. In a lot of the United States, for example, a lot of these things are legislated, which doesn't always solve the problem, but I find it an interesting approach. For example, given that left-handers form X percentage of the population, there would be, if you had those right and left-handed type desks, there would be a requisite number of left-handed desks, because you'd be predicting that there would be at least three people in this group, for example, that would be left-handers, and they deserve to have their left-handed desk. Okay. Now, so we can try and change the culture that way. And if we're women, we can try and change the culture so that we serve the interests of both men and women much more equitably. Now, I think just as we often in our everyday lives fail to realize the pervasiveness of the male viewpoint in our society, so psychologists fail to realize this when they begin to work from a psychological perspective and to examine certain aspects. Now, in an excellent paper on just this topic, Naomi Weisstein, and it's on your list for week five, clearly emphasizes that psychology in general has embraced the sexist norms of our culture. In particular, psychology does not understand women or people. And she asserts there are two main reasons why psychologists do not understand. One reason is the clinical therapists, whether they're psychologists or psychiatrists, have acted unscientifically by accepting theory without evidence. Okay? So some branches of psychology are accepting theory without evidence. They're behaving, if you like, unscientifically. Another sub-area of psychology, which you might call the academic personality researchers, are guilty of adopting the male perspective when they ignore the social context of behaviour in favour of inner traits. Now, this ignoring the social context is a real crime in psychology. It cuts right across areas. It doesn't relate just to the psychology of women. It relates to psychology in general. Well, let's just look very briefly at the issue of theory without evidence and where psychology accepts this. So let us turn briefly, very briefly, to the classic theory of Freud. Classic in the sense that I noticed recently an American psychologist, they had a literature search on the most cited psychologists of the world kind of thing, the top 10 in psychology. And guess who number one was? Good old Father Freud. Most cited psychologist in history, and to my mind probably the most pernicious and damaging influence on psychology in general and the psychology of women in particular. But let's look very briefly at Freudian theory, and I mean briefly because I hate to perseverate on mentioning his name any more frequently. If we look at the Freudian theory, we have this idea that in childhood, very early childhood, infancy, both sexes go through the oral period, the oral anal developmental periods. Then there's this magical time, around about five, when differences in genitalia are discovered. And nobody will question that. I mean, that is about the time the kids find out, and it's a really big thing. The girl discovers that she's deficient in this regard. Lack of a penis becomes the focal issue. The big trauma in the life at this particular point in time is penis envy. The girl feels mutilated, envious, cheated, and angry. This is all according to Freud. She envies the boy who has this magical attribute, blames and rejects the mother, and turns to the father. Now, this is obviously a very briefly condensed version of Freud. Now, finally, direction.
intensity of some eternal desire is thus going to be proportional to her unresolved wish for things. So the woman's greatest fulfillment is achieved when she has a child, and especially when she has a son, and thus acquires indirectly the usage. Now, I kid you not, this is all terribly serious.
So you might say, as Bardwick does, that the primary motives of women thus derive from a poor attempt at sublimating impulses that emanate from a lack of male genitals. In brief and in summary, that's what Freud is saying. Now, I'm not going into all the complexities of Freudian theory here. To my mind, it would be a fruitless exercise. But I do think that it's important to look at the theory and the criticisms of the theory, as Weinstein does, because we need to be able to reject this kind of nonsense. Now, the main plus for Freudian psychoanalysis is that it's based on accumulated clinical experience. And believe me, I've been in enough clinical situations where I do not in any way denigrate the value of accumulated experience. There are things that you learn that you can never learn out of a textbook. And you become more sensitive, you learn the skills of rapport and everything else. And as Weinstein says, if Freud wants to found a theory on those clinical experiences, he's entitled to do so. He's just as entitled to found one from a table of random numbers, if he so chooses. But having done so, your theory must then be testable. If psychology is a science, and we're claiming it, we're arguing that we should be able to present theories from which we can derive hypotheses, which we can examine and empirically investigate. Now, there are boodles of problems in psychoanalytic theory, and among these are some of the following. The evidence is totally contaminated. When Freud looks for evidence supporting his viewpoint, it usually comes from people who are already in therapy and are therefore presumably either having problems, obviously not the so-called normal people because they're in therapy in the first place, are devoted to Freudian psychology, or they wouldn't have chosen psychoanalysis in the second place. They're hardly what you call an objective source of evidence. So when he investigates the sexual development of a five-year-old child called Little Hans and describes that development in terms of his theory on the basis of comments made by Hans's father, who is also in therapy, your objectivity might be just a little suspect. You could also note that his observations, for the most part, were based on affluent Viennese women during the Victorian era. And you might wonder whether Viennese women from the Victorian era could be generalized across places or across time. His patients were substantially neurotic people. You might wonder about the capacity to generalize from that neurotics to so-called normals in our society. I keep saying so-called because I'm not really sure what normal is, but we'll take it for the moment as the general people. But the main criticism of Freudian theory that we can make from a scientific viewpoint is that the theories are simply not testable. The theory is simply immune to falsification. There is no way you can falsify it because the same behavior can be predicted from two different sources, or two different sources can predict the same behavior. Let me give you an example. We can say that in, for example, in the oral stage, the child suffered frustrating stimulation. Either they got too much oral stimulation or they got too little oral stimulation. Later in life, they're going to be rapid chain smokers. Now, you can't test that. You're testing it from two things which are the opposite. One is that they didn't get enough, and one is that they got too much, and you're assuming that a behavior at the end can be related to either of those sources. So, you know, it's impossible to disprove it. If you look at the penis envy idea, for example, there's no way that we can produce any evidence which can refute this successfully to Freudians. Now, if a woman is passive in her adult life, they say, well, she sublimated the penis envy. If she's aggressive, well, she's also sublimated it, just in a different way. There's no way you can come up with a prediction which you can then test and say, that is true or is not true. We're not talking here about theory, we're talking about dogma. It's an ideological thing. It's like having faith. You know, you either believe in it or you don't. And not only the original Freudian theory, but its derivations are also subject to these criticisms. And there are lots of psychoanalysts today who use a whole variety of tools which are supposed to make the whole scheme much more scientific. They use things like the Rorschach test, which is usually more commonly known as the ink blot system. And I'll show you an ink blot and see what you think about it. It's almost impossible to get reliability on that. You can train people up for years and they still won't agree with each other on what a particular interpretation of a particular ink blot actually means. So that you can't decide a person is crazy or non-crazy or, you know, fitting in or not fitting in on the basis of that. So modern psychoanalysis cannot predict any better than Freudian psychoanalysis originally. Now, it's somewhat incredible, really, to realize that this theory has had such an overshadowing influence on the psychology, on the science of psychology, and on understanding women. It's, as I said, the most cited theory, the most cited theorist, and it just seems, you know, just impossible to me that this state of affairs has arisen. Well, let's turn now to Weinstein's second criticism. She says that psychology has made a major mistake by focusing on the inner causes, inner dynamic causes. She says we need to turn away from this focus and examine behavior in its social context. Now let's just think briefly about social context. Psychologists are very fond of experiments. They dream up lots of absolutely marvelous ones. But in the course of all this, wonderful series of experiments was conducted by Martin Orwin. And all he was trying to do was suggest that laboratory experiments may not be telling us what we think they're telling us. You know, there may be lots of things in the nature of it being an experiment which forces behavior which would not naturally occur. He gave us an example. He was trying out these ideas originally. He went up to a few of his friends and said, do 5 push-ups for me. And they typically would look at him like he was crazy and say, why? But when he went around a similar sample of his friends and said, I want to do a quick experiment, do 5 push-ups for me, the typical response was, where? You know, you say this is an experiment and suddenly it takes on a totally different aura. Suddenly we're doing, you know, something that's very important for some reason and acquires a whole lot of scientific validity. Now, Orwin was interested in this and in how much people would do simply because they thought they were in an experiment. So in this sense, he's interested in the social context of what's going on. And he was looking originally, not for the reason of finding the social context, but initially to see if he could come up with a really boring task, which he wanted to use in another experiment, which is totally independent of this. So he had to run a few things to see if he could come up with something that was really boring. And one task he designed was to perform serial additions of each adjacent 2 numbers on sheets filled with rows of random digits. In order to complete just 1 sheet, the subject would be required to perform 224 additions. A stack of some 2,000 sheets was presented to each subject. Now, it's clearly an impossible task to complete, right? So the experimenter comes in, takes the subject's watch and says, continue to work, I will return eventually. And eventually the experimenter gave up. This was 5.5 hours later. The subjects were still sitting there doing their boring task. Now he thought about this and he thought, well, you know, there must be some way you can really make this so that they'll crack pretty quickly. And so he added a small item to it. He told them that when they were to do exactly the same task, new bunch of subjects, right, we're starting again. when they had finished the additions on the first sheet, they had to pick up a card. And the card read, you had to tear up the sheet of paper which you've just completed into a minimum of 32 pieces and go on to the next sheet of paper and continue working as you did before. When you have collected this piece of paper, pick up the next card which will instruct you further. Work as accurately and as rapidly as you can. Now, of course, every time the subject completed the paper and tore it up into 32 pieces, they picked up the next card read exactly identical to the first card. And Orton was under the impression that, you know, given this, was obviously a pointless task which nobody was even going to look at, that they would give up, but they didn't. And he is using this as an assertion that psychologists in general may be doing a lot of very clever things for a lot of reasons, that they are just not getting validity in their experiments. You know, they're getting all these exciting things going simply because it is, perhaps, an experiment and not because it's what would be occurring out in the real world. Another series of studies was done by Rosenthal and Jacobson on along similar lines, but they were looking at contamination of data in the social context for a variety of reasons. What they did was they had various tasks which don't really matter. For example, subjects would be asked to rate faces, and they had people running their experiments, and their real experiment was with the experimenters. So they told the experimenters, well, you know, typically people rate these sets of photographs as competent people. And they might tell the other half that typically these are rated as incompetent. Lo and behold, even though the identical set of instructions are given by the experimenters to the subjects in the rating procedure, they get different data. The experimenters who are told they've got competent photographs get competent ratings. The other ones, identical photographs, get incompetent ratings. Rosenthal is talking about here expectations that are set up. It's not that anybody's fudging the data. I mean, they don't just sit down and change all the scores. The crux of the problem is that somehow, when we expect certain things like that, we set up cues which elicit certain responses from our subjects. And in a very interesting adaptation of this problem to the real world, Rosenthal and Jacobson examined this effect in a classroom situation. They assigned a number of subjects to two groups, matching them for so-called intelligence. They told the teachers that one group, this group over here, they're going to be late bloomers. They're really bright kids. They're going to bloom this year. And the other group, they said nothing about. At the end of the year, the bloomers had bloomed. I mean, there they were. They were bright kids, bright and intelligent, even though the year before they'd just been ordinary old kids in the middle of the range somewhere. Now, Rosenthal and Jacobson are talking about this because these sorts of expectations will colour not only what you look for, what you expect, and what you get in an experiment. They'll also colour what's going on in the real world. Now, if you expect to be treated as somebody who is incompetent, non-assertive, you generate cues which other people are responding to. If you have the impression of yourself that, well, I'm not all that good at maths, you're probably going to feel that way. People are going to respond to you that way. If you come on like you really know your topic, then people are going to respond to that. They'll give you credit for looking competent, assertive, and so on. There's one other set of experiments which I wanted to mention briefly, which some of you will also be familiar with. But I think they're also important because they show the distinction between certain types of laboratory experiments. And these are the Milgram studies. Now, Milgram was interested in conformity, social conformity. And he asked the question, under what conditions will people do things that one wouldn't normally expect them to do? And he arranged a situation in which there was a teacher and a learner. Now, the learner was a stooge. The experimenter had chosen the learner. But the teacher didn't know this. teacher was the real subject in the experiment. And the teacher was told that they had to teach this person, their subject, paired words. So it might be cat, dog, you know, apple, orange, whatever. It was the task. The learner was put in a room and they communicated by a tape in the original, by microphone in the original version of the experiment. Now, the teacher's role in this was to punish the learner whenever they made a mistake, right? So you say cat and the person says apple. And the punishment in this case was a choice of 30 switches which started at the bottom at 15 volts, slowly worked its way up over the 30 switches until it read 450 volts, danger, and then XXX on the last two with no numbers on it. And the teacher was told, you start with the low one and you work your way up. They're not learning, you just keep going. Right? Now you remember the learner was a stooge, so the real purpose of the experiment was to see how far these people would go. Would they really shock a person beyond what was considered to be a reasonable shock level? And they even gave them a little shock at the lowest levels when they started out so they'd have some idea of what it felt like. Right? Over 60% of people in that situation went all the way. I mean, even though they could hear the person screaming and yelling on the other side and uttering great agonizing cries, let me out of here, let me out of here. People who had told them before they went into the situation that they had a weak heart, they still kept going, over 60%. That means that in a similar situation, more than half of you would probably respond in exactly the same way. Now, Milgram also ran this on a variety of conditions, and I think this is what's important. It's not so important that people respond simply under an experimental situation like that and conform to the pressures of the experiment, which may be what's happening. But there are a number of conditions under which people won't do this. And I think this is interesting. We may have applications for a psychology of women. People won't respond if the person's very close to them, physically close, or they'll respond much less. Now, if you look at it, if you can hear the person, if you can see the person, if you can touch the person, then people conform less and less as the person becomes physically closer to them. Right? So you might, for example, think of people who are very sexist. They may be extremely sexist in terms of their general attitudes. They may be very liberated in their attitudes towards one particular woman. This is not an uncommon phenomenon. The other thing is that Milgram also found that when a person placed in that stressful situation of turning on the switches was given a stooge to help them, so they put in a couple of Confederates who'd say things like, "Oh, I'm not going to do this stupid experiment," they wouldn't succumb so easily. When they had a little bit of peer support, they wouldn't crumble under the stress. And I think there's a message in that too, if you're trying to change some sort of social conventions. And it's obviously a lot easier to do it if you've got a little bit of company on the way than if you're not. Now, the point that Weinstein is trying to make there in these two criticisms, and if we can go back to them briefly for a moment, one was that the theories that psychologists are using have been totally incompetent. The theories which have dominated have been totally unacceptable. And the second was that we've ignored the social context. I think that certainly we don't want a Freudian psychology of women, point one. And point two, we do need to consider the social context much more closely, not just in terms of experiments like Milgram. We need to change around the whole total way that we begin to look at psychology. Cox has a number of suggestions, and I won't dwell on them, but she says that if we have a feminist or a psychology of women based on a feminist theory, then we're going to have a psychology which really will begin to understand women. And her arguments or descriptions of this kind of psychology of women centre around things like a need for an interdisciplinary science, which is something you should have been discussing recently, I take it. So you should have had firm opinions for that, hopefully, by now. She says that what we need is an interdisciplinary study. We need to integrate thinking and feeling, and not just, you know, objective, so-called objective value-free measures, which obviously are neither objective nor value-free in a whole lot of situations. We need to have an explicit concern for values. Obviously, the notion that science or psychology is value-free is absurd, and that we need this a sensitivity to other points of view. It's okay. I think we're just about out of time anyway. But I think that if you take a look at Cox sometime, I think you'll probably find her arguments fairly persuasive. I didn't think of it. Well, yeah, we can put it on next year. If anybody has any questions any time, that's fine too. You can please interrupt. I should have said that before.